All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name's Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
My name's Fred. I'm an alcoholic.
Oh, Fred.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal story describes in their own language and from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut ideas of what has happened in their life. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, enlisting later on PABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them, I must have this thing. Okay. I was asked to introduce Jimmy, and he was over there telling me to say some lies about him, like he was 6'5 before he got sober. I don't think that was the case, but I've only really gotten to know him in the past year, but he has been here ever since I've been here, which is a long time. He's always been down at the table for the Thursday night dinner, and then for the Thursday night men's meet, and he's always over in this section. And it used to be 15 years ago he shared. I remember hearing that one time. Anyway, he's had some health problems. I've had some health problems. We had a chance to kind of get to know each other these past 6 months. And he's a perfect victim for me because I'm curious. I like to ask questions. And he's got lots of information, background stuff going on. And I've formed a nice relationship with him. And I've been looking forward to hearing his story tonight.
My name is Jimmy, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 11/11/1981. My story starts when I was just a young boy. I was born in Lynette, Alabama, small mill town. My family, there was two positive things about the family. One was we were poor. That was an absolute fact. We lived in a housing project. My mother was a wonderful woman. She was my hero till the day she passed away. She worked hard to support the family. She fed the kids and kept us in clothes. And she paid that $14 rent every month for us to live in that housing project. $14, that's what it cost us. And she told me often that it was hard to come up with $14. But she did. And I had a brother and a sister. And I also had a father. My father, though, couldn't or wouldn't work. In Lynette, everybody knew him, and everybody knew him as the town drunk. They always said that he was bad to drink. He drank too often, too much, and when he did, he got bad. And he did. My father wasn't a happy alcoholic. When he drank, he got mean, and it was always against my mother. The second thing about our family that was a fact was we were dysfunctional, back before I ever heard of the word dysfunctional. We lived together in these two bedrooms, but we never functioned as a family. We never had a vacation. We never did anything together. We didn't go to movies. We had no TV, no telephone, no car. And so we just existed. And it was always this tension. Because when I can start remembering it, my mother was always mad at him because he drank all the time. He stayed mad at her because he didn't like her telling him how to drink or to quit drinking. So it was always this tension. And at first, my dad was just very verbal up towards my mother. He would call her names and call her all kinds of things right in front of the kids. And eventually we just leave the house, get out of there. But he got to coming home drunk. And when he came home drunk, he would be physical. And he would come home all hours of the night. He'd start beating on her. And when he'd start beating on it, my brother and sister and I, we would jump on him, try to get him off our mother. I was scared to death of him. I was afraid he was going to kill her. And like I said, we didn't have a telephone, so when it got really bad, the people in the next apartment, through that wall, they could hear it. They'd call the police. The police would come, get him, take him out, take him to jail. I thought they was arrested him. They didn't never arrest him. They just took him down, let him sleep it off, because the next morning, real early, they'd bring him back home. So now he's back home. He'd walk in, never said a word. Never said, "I'm sorry. Did I hurt anybody? I won't do it again." He'd go to bed, sleep it off. And he would do that till it got time to get dressed, and he'd walk out. He had to walk everywhere because we didn't have a car. He'd leave the house, and you never knew what condition he was going to come back home in. Most of the time, he'd come home drunk. Be another fight. That's the way we lived. Day after day, time after time. That's all I remember about it. That's all I remember about him. Now, this was 1954. I was 10 years old. And something happened that year. Something happened then that changed the whole thing. He died. And when he died, I remember my mother came in the bedroom where my sister and brother and I lived. I slept. Woke us up to tell us that our dad wouldn't be coming home again, that he had gotten killed in a car wreck. And she was really upset about it. And I didn't quite understand why, because it didn't upset me one bit. I was glad he was dead. I was glad he was never coming home and going to beat on anybody again. I had enough of that. And a couple of days later, we had the funeral. My mother's still crying. She cried for 3 straight days over this man. I remember at the funeral, I'm sitting on the front row with the family, and I'm just sitting there. My grandfather walks over and said, "Jimmy, if you want, I'll walk up to the casket with you, and I'll let you say goodbye to your father." I said, "Granddaddy, I don't have anything to say to him." And I just sat there. I never moved. That was the end of him. At that time, my mother was 7 months pregnant. We was going to have a new baby in December. We'd been told we was going to have a Christmas baby. Now, my thinking was, he's gone. We got rid of that, and we got a new life coming. We're going to have a new baby in the family. So I thought we had a great beginning that we would be okay with. And my mother went to the hospital on December the 15th to have the baby. And the baby was stillborn. So instead of having a new baby, we had 2 funerals in 2 months. We didn't have a Christmas. 1954 wasn't a good year for us, but we lived through it. We got through it. After it was all over, though, and things settled down, they had, for something or another, had gotten into my mind. I didn't like that town. I didn't like anybody in it. Nobody treated us. They treated us like we were nobodies. We lived in a housing project, wrong side of town. We had no money. We had no car. We had nothing. We walked everywhere we went. We were just poor. And I guess you could say we was poor white trash. I don't know. But that's the way they felt about us. We were nobodies. And I knew that. And the other thing that bothered me was I felt like all they did was feel sorry for us. And let me tell you, the worst feeling in the world is to have somebody feel sorry for you. Don't like me. Don't get around me. Do whatever you want to do. Just don't feel sorry for me. I can't stand that. Couldn't then. I still don't like it. But I felt like that's what that town did. And I'll tell you 2 quick examples. The day after my father died, the very next day, my mother sends my brother and I down to get a haircut. We got to look good for the funeral. And we did. So I'm in there getting a haircut, and my brother's sitting over there waiting to do it next. And this guy walks in. He sits down. Don't know him. He sat there for a couple of minutes. And all of a sudden, he comes out with, "I heard where Leon Cribb got killed last night in a car wreck. The way he lived, I'm not surprised." Well, That struck me as not being very nice. The barber spoke up real quick to say, yeah, this is Leon's two sons. Well, then he started backtracking. And he said, oh, well, I was sorry to hear about your dad. No, he wasn't. He done told me how he felt. I knew how he felt. So he could forget it. And the other thing was, several months later, down the road, I was going out for Little League Baseball. And I was down at the Recreation Center, getting signed up. And the guy that was running the show was putting me with a team. And he brought the coach over that didn't know me, and I didn't know him. And he said, hey, coach, I want you to meet somebody. This is Leon Cripps' son. I still didn't have a name. I'm still Leon Cripps' son. And it pissed me off. I thought, this ain't right. I got a name. I'm somebody. And that's where it come up with the phrase, I'm going to be somebody. Because then I knew they didn't think I was anybody. So those two things had an idea on what I thought about them. And so after that, I came up with a brilliant idea. Now, I'm 11 years old by now. And from 11 years old, I was pretty sharp. I came up with this idea, and y'all are going to appreciate it. I found out that, we'll jump ahead, in the big book, Doctor's Opinion, and I can't quote the exact word for word, but you'll know it. It states in there that the natural state of an alcoholic is to be restless, irritable, and discontented unless he can get the immediate comfort of taking a few drinks. That's what it says. And it's true. Well, I was restless, irritable, and discontented my whole life as an 11-year-old boy. I was never happy. Nobody ever accused me of having a sense of humor. I didn't. There was nothing funny going on in my life. And everything was a serious event. So that's the way I was. And I guess it took it too serious. But my idea was this. I found out that if I was a people pleaser, if I could do something and make you smile or compliment me, then I felt good. That I felt like I was somebody as long as I got the right response back. So all I had to do is just be a people pleaser. Well, we all know what that's like. That's a big challenge if you're going to take that on for life. Well, I did. That's all I wanted to do was be a people pleaser. And as long as I could do that, then that restless, irritable discontent went away. But the minute I got locked into nothing was going on, that attitude came back. I was looking for something to do. I didn't take a drink, so I got to work on that. And so that was the way I got through life. I got through school, and I'm not going to name everything because I'll be up here all night, but all the way through school, high school, everywhere, that was my attitude. Everything I did was for me. I never did anything for anybody else. It was always, what am I going to get back out of it? You know, I might make you feel good, but I'm counting on what you're going to do to me. And that's the way I operated. I did that all the way through school. I didn't drink. I would not drink because of my father. So I got into the first time I tried to drink, I think I was a senior in high school. And I ran around with three or four guys that was good teenagers. Nothing special. But on the weekend, we'd get together and try to pool our money, pocket change, because that's all any of us had, and buy a six-pack of beer. And so we did. And the first time they bought it, they gave me a beer, and I tried it. And I didn't like it. I just didn't like the taste of beer. I gave it back to them, told them I wasn't going to drink it. So they said, okay, Jimmy can't drink. We're going to make him the designated driver. So I became the designated driver to these guys. But you know what that did? It made me feel like I was special. See, I was the driver. They was just drinking. I was the driver. I controlled the situation. I thought that was cool. So that was my experience with drinking as a senior in high school. Didn't like it. It wasn't successful. The other thing, when I was a senior, I did something. I got to watch time. I get talking on one subject, and I need to move on. But when I was a senior in high school, there's something I did it ended up being great. It could have ended up being the worst thing I ever done. I met a girl. She was Miss Homecoming Queen. She was Miss Valley High. She also was the prettiest girl in the senior class. And for some reason, she started taking up with me. And all the guys that was friends of mine would tell me that she was way out of my league, that they didn't see anything that she would see in me. But she did. And that made me feel good. So I used her as sort of that feel good. And I was showing her off. This is my girl. She loves me. And the reason I said it worked out okay, because we went together, we got engaged, we got out of high school, we came to Atlanta. And she got a job, and I got a job up here. And we got engaged, and a year or so we got married. At that time, I had gone to work in an automobile dealership in Decatur. And I had always wanted to build a race car. Now, I don't know why I never had a dime, but I wanted to build a race car. So there I was working at a dealership, and I had everything there in front of me to use. Anything I wanted to use after hours, I could use it. So it was a great opportunity. So I started building a 55 Chevrolet dragster, and it was nice. I loved that car, and got married to my wife. And at first, my wife didn't say anything, but what I did to her, once I had her, once she was mine, once we got married, she was mine. I set her aside because it wasn't a challenge anymore, I guess. But that car became my whole life. I worked on it every night. And then when I finally got it running, we went drag racing every weekend. That's what I did. And I kept that car about 3 years racing, and one day, she about had enough of that. She quit going because she saw how I reacted at the racetrack. Now, you're talking about a kid on a cloud nine in a racetrack. I had no problems. I was in hog heaven at the racetrack because those people would come over, and they would tell me how nice a car I had. And they'd tell me how fast it ran and what a great job I did. And I just ate all that up. I couldn't have won enough money racing to overcome that. I didn't win that much anyway, because you'll never win enough money racing. But all I raced for was for that. And so that made me happy. Every week, I lived for Sunday to go racing. And my wife finally got tired of that. She quit going. And she came to me one day and told me that I made her a promise that, and I did, I just forgot it, that when we decided to have a family, settle down, I quit being a kid, we'd buy a home. We'd have a family. So one day, she came and presented that with me. And I guess I thought she never would remember that. But but she did. And I knew she was right. I had given her my word. I've done a lot of dishonest things in my life. But I gave her my word, and I kept it. So I wasn't happy. But I told her, okay, you go find us a home. I'll find somebody to buy my car, and I'll buy that house. And we did. She went right away and found a house pretty quick. And I had to go find somebody to buy my race car. And I did. So all the money I got, plus the money that we'd saved living in a little apartment in Atlanta, I put together and we bought this house. So I don't have a race car, but in the meantime, she got pregnant with our first daughter months down the road. So now, I got still got a good job at the dealership. Next thing I had was still got the prettiest wife. She still was pretty. Now I had a new daughter, wonderful daughter, and now I got a nice home. Now, what else would you want? I mean, if I had to stop and say I have reached it, I have become somebody, that would have been the time. but I wasn't happy. I just couldn't get over not having that race car. It bothered me to no end. And I got mad with her. I got a resentment to her because it was her fault that I didn't have the car. If it hadn't been for her, I wouldn't have sold it. So, attitude got bad again. Restless, irritable, and discontent. Here we are again. I got where I didn't like my job. I didn't like the people there. I certainly didn't like her. And we had the baby. And I couldn't be a father. I didn't know anything about being a father. So I wasn't a father. So that went on for a while. I started drinking. Now, this one I started drinking more with the guys at Royal. That's the name of the dealership now. It wasn't Royal when I worked there then. I gave it away, Royal Oldsmobile. But when I started, it was Callaway Motors. We had a couple of mechanics there that after hours, they bring in a cooler and they go set it in their stall and they sit up and drink beer for a couple of hours before they go home. I started joining them. I'd go up there after work and sit down. We'd drink beer together. And then I'd go home. But that was a temporary fix. I still wasn't happy. I couldn't get over that car. I needed something else to take the place of that car. And this is what I did. And you got to remember that car was that important. I got to have something really big if I'm going to replace it. Strangest thing. I'm driving home one day after work. Had a bad day at work. Still ain't happy. I'm going out to Claremont to the house. In Claremont, there's a YMCA. May still be there. I don't know. But is it? Okay. On the marquee out there, it said, Master Eugene Kim, Korean Karate, was stuck up there. And I swear to you, I have no idea why I turned that car and went in that driveway. I didn't know any more about karate than I did AA. But I pulled in, got out, and I went in. I sat down and watched it. I thought it was interesting, watching all those guys fighting and going through forms and doing whatever. And so I stayed the whole class. That was exciting to me. So after it was over, he came over and started talking to me and asked me if I wanted to join. It was only two nights a week, 1 hour a night. It was only $25 a month. All I had to do was sign up for 1 month. I did it. Now, I've got in the car and I'm heading home, and I've really had this I was like a kid at Christmas. It was that exciting to me. I couldn't wait to get home and tell my wife. And I did. I went home, sat down at dinner, and I shared the good news with her. wasn't good about that news. She knew me. And she looked at me. My daughter was sitting over there in the high chair. She looked at me and said, "What the hell were you thinking?" I said, "Well, it's only a month, and I'm only going to go twice a week for an hour. That's all. It'll be good exercise." That was my story. So 7 years later, I had to retire from karate. Not a month, 7 years. I ruptured a disc in my neck and had to have a neck operation. I'd made black belt because, real quick, in karate, some of you may know and some of you don't, when you go in, you're a white belt. That means you're nobody. Everybody's just nobodies. But as you build up belts, you change, you become somebody. Now, if you want to be somebody, you get a black belt. You earn a black belt, and you'll be somebody. And once a black belt, you're always a black belt. I'm still a black belt. I'm an old one, but I can walk into a dojo, a studio, with my D uniform, black belt on, and the people will stop, turn around, and bow, and say, "Sir," to me. Now, that's pretty cool. I love that stuff. Now, out here on the regular street, they don't give a darn. I mean, they ain't nobody going to bow to you. But in a karate studio, they do. So, that was it. I made black belt. For 3 years, I was a black belt. But I got hurt, and I ended up having to have an operation at Emory. And all that time, while I was going through that, the drinking was just like it always been. Sociably, I drink enough. I drink enough to know that when I drank four or five beers or whatever it was, I got high. I got this buzz on where I felt smooth. I wasn't high. I wasn't low. I was where I wanted to be. I just couldn't stay there. And so when I went into Emory, first thing they did was give me a shot of Demerol. And I thought, well, that stuff ain't bad. I like that. And it was. It solved the problem. But you can't get a lot of Demerol. So I did take it as long as I could. And then the doctor cut me off and started me on a lesser painkiller. And then he cut me off from that. And after it was all over, several months, I didn't have no painkillers. So I went back to drinking. And so I'm back to drinking, and I've been on drugs, and I'm going through withdrawals. I end up in the hospital again because I'm run down so much. And the doctor told me that they had checked me out. I'd lost a lot of weight, wasn't eating, didn't work. That he finally found out what was wrong with me. I was just a hyper little fella, and I needed to take a Valium every day, and I'd feel better. And Valiums weren't addictive. Except you couldn't drink with them. You could take Valium. They're not addictive, but don't drink with them. You don't drink, do you? No, I don't drink. You know, to this day, I've never told a doctor that I drank. If he asked me today, I tell him, nope. Well, I don't drink now. But I never admitted I drank to a doctor. And I told him, no, I don't drink. Well, that was a lie, because 2 days out of the hospital, I'm at home with a beer and a Valium, and I found out how it boosted it up. So I started living on Valiums and alcohol. And I'd gone from beer to wine, and I love rum and Coke. So I drink rum and Coke and a Valium, and I'd pass out sitting in my recliner every night. That's the way I lived. I went through that. I don't know how long, a long time. And my job had gotten bad because of the way I was. And my wife had gotten fed up with me. And she come to me and told me that the boss man was getting ready to fire me. He'd been talking to her about me. And I knew he was. And she said, I just want to tell you that. Now, this was November 1981. That after Thanksgiving, I'm taking the two kids. And by then, I'd had a second daughter. And we're leaving. We're going to have Thanksgiving dinner together, because we always do. But the next day, I'm going to live with my sister. And I'm taking the two girls. And I knew she meant it. Every morning, I looked in that mirror. And the guy I looked at and saw, only thing I could come up with was, you worked all these years to be somebody, and you are a nobody. You are nothing. And that's what I thought. But I couldn't stand that guy that I looked at every day in the mirror. Couldn't stand him. So I made a decision. I'm going to simply quit drinking. I did it so I can quit. So first thing I did was quit the Valiums. I'm going to quit taking Valiums. Then I'm going to quit drinking. And then I'm going to take about a week to get better. So I quit taking Valiums. But I started drinking more. Then I said, okay, I'm going to cut out drinking. But I ended up taking back Valiums again. Because you know what? The feel of the good feel of drinking had long passed me by. What it has done was I was going to die if I didn't keep drinking. I honestly felt like every day that I went without drinking, I felt so bad that I thought I was going to die. I had to go take a drink to get through it. And that's the way it was. So I had this plan that I implemented to quit drinking. And you all know it didn't work. With drugs, without drugs. But the main thing was I kept drinking, and I couldn't quit drinking. My wife was leaving me with her daughters. My boss was trying to fire me, and I couldn't quit drinking. What the hell had I become? Now, I prayed to God most all my life. And I had a great prayer that would swap A for B and B for C. He'd do this, I'd do that. God, I want to do this. If you'll do that, all you got to do is help me out. Well, he never did. And this night, I'm standing in a dark room. I did photography, and I was printing black and white prints in a dark room. So it was a dark room. And as I was working, I was feeling so bad, and I knew the end was in sight. Out of the blue, I said, God, if there is a God, I need you to come into my life and take over. For 37 years, I've done everything to control my life, and this is where it got me. I can't go any further. If this is it, I want to die. I want to die now. But if you've got a purpose for me, if there is a reason, then I need for you to come into my life and show me the way. End of the prayer. Shut it down. Went and had a drink, sat in my recliner, and went to sleep. Next morning, I woke up, got my suit on, went to work. And on the way to work, this is where it changed. This is what God did. On the way to work, I said, I got to reach out and talk to somebody. Who am I going to talk to? This name came to me. And I'll tell you who it is. He's proud of it. His name is John. He was a player for the Atlanta Falcons. He's a punter. And a wonderful person. We'd gotten to be friends. But his name came to me. And so I called him. Told him a little bit about what was going on. And he said, well, won't you come to the house? We'll have lunch. And we'll sit down and we'll talk. And I did. So I went and I told him as much as I could about what my life had become. And he said, all right, I want you to go home, take care of yourself. Monday, you'll get a phone call. Monday morning, I went to work. I got to my office, the phone rang. Picked it up, and it was him. He said, Dr. Harrison wants you at the Piedmont Hospital at 10 o'clock. He needs to see you, talk to you. So I stopped, told him at work, I'm going to the hospital. I drove down to Piedmont, walked in and saw Dr. Harrison. Dr. Harrison was a team physician for the Atlanta Falcons, the head doctor. I walked in, and I talked to him for about 3 minutes. That was it. And he reached over, and he got his prescription pad, and he started writing on it. And my thought was, he's writing me a prescription for something. I hope it's good. And he tore it off, and he slid it across the desk to me. Well, I reached over and got it and looked at it. You'll never believe what he wrote. Richview Institute. And with a phone number. I said, Doctor, I don't need an institution. I just need to quit drinking. He said, yeah, I know you do. That's where you're going to go. Call him. Ask for Polly Talbert. And I said, well, call him up there and check on everything for me. And he said then, no, it's up to you. You got to start now getting well. And so I took it home, talked to my wife. She thought it was worth a try. I went to my boss, who was getting ready to fire me. He still wasn't happy with me, but I had insurance that would pay it. So I went to Ridgeview. And I checked in there on a Monday morning, and I got to get out of this thing. And I checked into Ridgeview. I stayed 28 days, and that was an eye opener for a kid that had always been in charge. But first day there, I spent all morning signing papers, getting ready. In the afternoon, I took a physical. I got my room. I got all set up. And about 5 o'clock, all these people started coming in. And they said, all right, everybody line up to go to dinner. So all these people just made a line. And they said, go get in line. So I went and got in line. We went down and had dinner together. We ate together. We couldn't leave till we all quit together. We come back up to the main room in a line. So I wasn't used to that. But anyway, we got back up there. And in the middle of the room was the head nurse for that shift. And she was quite a forceful lady. And she announced to the whole group, don't forget, this is AA night. The vans will be ready to leave about 7 o'clock. Don't be late. Be on the van. Well, my attitude was, I didn't come up here for no AA. I come up here to quit drinking. And so I went and told her. Listen, I didn't come up here for AA meetings. I've been here all day and I'm tired. I think I'm going to stay in my room and rest. And she looked at me and she said, look, you making the decision got your ass in here. Excuse my language. Got your ass in here. Now, I'm going to make the decision to get your ass out of here. So do as you're told. Be on the van. She walked off. Well, a young man was standing over across the room, and he heard it. And I think he was waiting to see what happened. He came over to me, and he told me, said, look, get on the van. Go with me. Get on the van. The meetings are not bad. They only last an hour, and that'll keep her off of you. So I met him at the van, got on it. We went to our first AA meeting in Marietta. Don't remember anything other than it was just a group of people that talked a lot. But I mean, I was in no position to understand anything in my first meeting. But in 28 days, I went to a lot of AA meetings. We had them every day at the hospital. And we traveled once a week to some AA meeting. So, okay, when I left Richie, I graduated in 28 days with a big book. A list of all the meetings around at Metro Atlanta, and a bottle of Anabuse, which I found out what that was for. But anyway, that's the way I got out of there. And a couple of days after I was out, one of the guys that had gotten out with me had come to NABA. He came to the Monday night meeting, speakers meeting. And he called me and said, look, I went to this NABA and they had a great meeting. Said, how about they're going to have another meeting on Thursday night? How about meeting me over there? So I came on Thursday night. Well, the Thursday night is the men's meeting. And I sat right in the middle. And that was a wild deal. We had smokers over here, non-smokers over here. I think it was. Anyway, and it was. They were rough. The old timers was rough. But I've been coming ever since. That's been over 36 years. I just keep coming back because I hadn't found any place else to go. Whenever I joined a group or anything, whether it's sports or scouts or whatever, I never fit in. Even when I was in a group, I never fit in. The only time I've ever fit in any place is when I walked in this door to this meeting. And I have never questioned, did I belong here? Did I fit in with everybody? Still do. So, now, I'm going to finish up real quick. I'm right on time, late time. But I want to share two real things with you about good news about what AA has done for me. Now, I talked about all of that stuff. But let me tell you, everything I got, I owe to AA. If I ever became somebody, it's because of AA. I'm not saying I have, but if I have, it's because of AA. I still have my beautiful wife, and that woman, whose name is Patty, we've been married 53 years, believe it or not. I'm not sure that speaks well of her, but anyway, we're still together. I got two wonderful daughters and two great-grandkids, so my life is good. And I have a great job now. What I do what I love. And so life is good. I owe it all to AA. Now, I was in this program for 25 years. I'm going to tell you this real quick as I can and get out of here. That I was 25 years into the program, and I had a brain aneurysm up at Flowery Branch. That's where I worked. And they had to rush me to the hospital. And they did some things to my head. It don't matter what it was. But anyway, they had to get me ready to do an emergency operation on the brain. And they got my wife up there. Doctor comes in, and he's starting to tell me what he's going to do. Now, I'll be honest with you, I'd just sooner a doctor don't tell me what he's going to do. Do it, and when I wake up, I'll take a look at it. But he wanted to go through and tell me all this about he's taking the skull out, and he's going, I don't care. Well, he went through all of that, and he said, now I got to tell you this. There's a 50-50 chance you're not going to live. And if you do live, there's less chance than that you're going to be the same person you are right now. You probably won't know your family. You may not have long-term or short-term memory. You may have trouble speaking. If you have a mini stroke, you're not going to be able to walk the same. And he went through all these things. And I'm sitting there. And he said, "Now, what can I discuss with you in detail? What do you want to know about?" I said, "Nothing." And he looked at my wife and said, "Look, I don't think he understands what I'm telling him. He don't understand the severity of what he's going to go through and what it's going to be like when it's over." And my wife, bless her heart, came out with a classic. She said, "Doctor, you don't understand him. He's a man of tremendous faith as well as I am. We'll be okay with whatever happens." And that was it. He said, "Okay." He went to go out the door. Because that was the truth. Now, the point I'm going to make out of this is faith. I learned that in AA. He went to go out that door. And I said, "Doctor, I do have a question." I guess I had one last funny line to say. He said, "Yeah, what can I ask him?" I said, "Have you ever done this operation before?" And he said, he didn't laugh. He said, "Well, of course I have. I'm a brain surgeon in a trauma unit. This is what I do." I said, "Well, good. I'm going to leave it up to you and God to get me through it. Good luck." And he said, "Okay." And he walked out the door. I didn't see him for about a week. I stayed unconscious, but finally I did meet him again. And I'm not going to go through all the details, but the truth is, most everything he said was going to happen did happen. I had to learn to speak again. You think this is good? I used to have really a trouble speaking. I stuttered. I would never get through this thing if I was still stuttering. But I had trouble walking. When I came back to this Thursday night men's group, I walked with a cane. Long-term memory, I lost a lot of that stuff. But anyway, a lot of the stuff he said would happen did happen. But it took me 2 years of working. I got through it. So the man you see tonight is the guy that got through all of that. And finally, I'm going to end up with this. One more thing about faith. I'm a big believer in faith. And faith is something you can't go looking for when you need it. You either got it or you don't. You better keep it ready because you never know when you're going to need it. And so, December the 26th, the day after Christmas, I had gotten sick last year. And that's where me and this oxygen come in. And my wife had to take me to the hospital, the emergency room, because I couldn't breathe. And so they did all kind of tests. They found out my problem is pulmonary fibrosis. And it doesn't matter what that is, but it's a disease of the lungs. It eats your lungs up. It's progressive. And it's going to kill you, depending on how bad it is already. Well, I got it. And because my lungs won't function, I have to have supplement oxygen. So I'm okay with that. And I said, I was going to keep a good attitude about dying in a couple of years. I mean, that's 2 years that some people don't have. Well, but the truth was, as I'd go to bed at night and get to thinking, my attitude wasn't as good. I started getting depressed about that. And I woke up one morning not feeling good about it. And my attitude was, where's the faith when you said you had it? What happened to that? What are you doing now? And so I said, okay, no more of that. Every day is a new day. I'm going to make the best of it today that I can make. And that's what I started doing. I'm still doing that. Now, finish this up. Last week, I went back to the doctor. I took CAT scans, x-rays that match up against what they did in January. The reason they do that, they want to find out how bad it was, how bad it's gotten, and they'll tell you how long you're going to live. So I'm sitting in the doctor's office waiting on the verdict. And in a minute, he comes walking in with the x-rays in his hands. And he says, "James," that's really my name, "James. If I owe you money, it's James. If we're friends, I'm Jimmy." So, "James, I owe him money." So he said, "James, I don't know how to explain this, but your x-rays," and he's pointing, "is better today than they were in January. I don't know why." I looked at them, and they were. They were clearing up. Now, the fibrosis is still there. It's gone. But what has not been damaged was clear that it was in January. And he said he didn't understand why. Evidently, what I was doing was working. The medication was working. And I said, "You know what, doctor? I think that's a miracle." See, I know about miracles. And He just smiled and said, "You know, I think you're right." See, now, I don't know if that's a miracle or not, but I had two miracles. That brain aneurysm wasn't my first miracle. Y'all all know what my first miracle was. It's the same one all of us have had. When God come into our life and took away the desire to drink, changed us, and got us here, then that's a miracle. I had that one, and that's the miracle of my life. Now, I had a lung operation, and I'm really going to quit, Tim. I promise you. I had a lung operation while I'm in the hospital. They had to do a biopsy and all. So they took out part of my lungs, sent it all, and I was in the hospital for 3 days. And when I got out, I was doing fine, and my wife come to get me. She's taking me home from the hospital, and we're driving. She's driving, and I'm sitting over there, and I ain't saying a word. And she said, "You know, Jimmy, I've been thinking about you. All you've been through, all the trouble you had with drinking and getting into AA and all that's done for you. And then you had to deal with that brain aneurysm. And all you went through for 2 years with that brain aneurysm. And you got through it okay. Now you've got fibrosis, which is terminal, and you're going to die from it. Have you ever thought about maybe it just be easy to go back and start drinking?" Now, I'm sitting up in the car, and I promise you, never have I ever thought about taking a drink. Never. And I looked at her, and I said, "Gee, Patty, you know, nothing that's going to happen to me is going to be improved by me taking a drink." We all know that. I had to re-educate her. And I said, "Listen, I got one thing. My only wish is this. When I do go, whenever it is, I want to go sober. And I hope everybody goes sober." Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. I have never seen a room hang on every word of someone's story, but they just did that, and so did I. That was really, really enlightening. Thank you. I have asked Dennis to come up and give out the chips.
Hey, I'm Dennis. I'm an alcoholic. We have a chip system here, and if you're new to the program and want to get a new way of life, want to start over, if you need a white chip and you want a new way of life, please come up and get one.